This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
For this Tuesday, July 14th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your headlines. Miami, Florida is now the epicenter of the COVID-19 pandemic, with more than 2,000 residents in that city hospitalized and hundreds in intensive care units. It comes as the FDA continues to monitor efforts for a vaccine. One drug company, Moderna, will begin a stage 3 trial of its potential vaccine beginning July 27th. It will be conducted in 87 locations across 30 states and the District of Columbia. By the way, the federal government is subsidizing the development of this potential breakthrough by pumping nearly $500 million into the project. The director of the CDC says the U.S. could get coronavirus under control in 1 to 2 months if every American simply wore a mask. Dr. Robert Redfield telling that to the Journal of American Medicine. He says the time is now. His remarks coming on the same day that four former CDC directors in an op-ed for The Washington Post titled, "We ran the CDC. No president has ever politicized its science the way President Trump has." And another cancellation as a result of this pandemic, Philadelphia announcing that the annual Mummers Day Parade in January will not take place. The story shaping Washington Today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on this Tuesday with news from the U.S. Supreme Court on the health of Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She is back in the hospital tonight, reportedly resting comfortably after undergoing treatment for a possible infection. In a statement, the court saying that Justice Ginsburg was evaluated at Sibley Memorial Hospital here in Washington this morning after experiencing fevers and chills overnight. She was later transferred to Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, where she underwent a medical procedure to clean out a bile duct stent that was placed in August. At the age of 87, she is the oldest active justice on the Supreme Court. Justice Ginsburg expected to remain hospitalized for the next few days in order to receive intravenous antibiotic treatments. And now to the White House with today's remarks in the Rose Garden by the president. It comes at a moment in which we're seeing a surge of coronavirus cases in 37 states, especially in the South and in the West. According to Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. has nearly 3.4 million confirmed cases. The death toll exceeding now 136,000 in this country. And despite criticism from the president, Dr. Anthony Fauci telling a Georgetown University group of students that you can, quote, trust him on this pandemic. We'll have more on that story in just a moment. The president using his remarks at the White House to announce that he has signed legislation that would impose mandatory sanctions on businesses and individuals that assist China in restricting Hong Kong's autonomy. The president also saying that he signed an executive order declaring that the U.S. would treat Hong Kong the same as mainland China, telling reporters he wants to hold China, quote, accountable. This side note, we take an in-depth look on the issue of U.S. and China with Danielle Pletka on our podcast, The Weekly. She is with the American Enterprise Institute. You can check that out at cspan.org/podcasts. More with the president earlier tonight.
This law gives my administration powerful new tools to hold responsible the individuals and the entities involved in extinguishing Hong Kong's freedom. We've all watched what happened. Not a good situation. Their freedom's been taken away, their rights have been taken away, and with it goes Hong Kong, in my opinion, because it will no longer be able to compete with free markets. A lot of people will be leaving Hong Kong, I suspect. And we're going to do a lot more business because of it, because we just lost one competitor. It's the way it is. We lost a very, very serious competitor, a competitor that we incentivized to take a lot of business and do well. And we gave them a lot of business by doing what we did. We gave them things that nobody else had the right to do, and that gave them a big edge over other markets. And because of that edge, they've done really historic business, tremendous business, far bigger than anybody would have thought years ago when we did this gift. It was really a gift to freedom.
That from the White House and today's Rose Garden news conference. Also, the Trump administration has reversed course and is backing away from a policy that would have stripped visas from international students. The move comes after the policy announcement last week, sparking a flurry of litigations, beginning with a lawsuit brought by Harvard and MIT that was followed by California's public colleges and later a coalition of 17 states. This latest development essentially canceling a move by the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Office, known as ICE, last week announcing that international students whose courses moved entirely online would be required to leave the country or transfer to another college or university. Harvard is beginning the fall semester with classes 100% online. And Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina facing a tougher-than-expected re-election battle today, defending Dr. Anthony Fauci, this amid efforts by top White House officials to discredit him. During a press conference in Columbia, South Carolina, Senator Graham telling reporters he has, quote, all the respect in the world for Dr. Fauci, and efforts to undermine the expert in infectious diseases is, in his words, not productive. Well, earlier today, Dr. Fauci speaking to students at a Georgetown University virtual teleconference with this summary of where things stand in the U.S. with regard to coronavirus.
So obviously we are in the middle of a global pandemic, and it's over 200 plus countries have been involved. It has really, in many respects, ravaged many, many parts of the world. We have a serious situation here in the United States. It's a mixed bag in the United States. You know, we have areas that have been hit really badly, like the New York metropolitan area, doing quite well now in getting the outbreak under control and trying in a stepwise, prudent fashion to open, and seem to be doing it successfully. The numbers are quite sobering. You know, we've had over 135,000 deaths in this pandemic for the United States. We have over 3 million cases. If you look globally, there's close to 600,000 deaths and about 13 or 14 million infections. So this is a pandemic of historic proportions. I think we can't deny that fact. It's something that I think when history looks back on it, it'll be comparable to what we saw in 1918. The situation that is the current challenge that we're facing right now is the resurgences of infections in the south and southwestern part of the country, with particularly in areas like California, Florida, Arizona, and Texas. They're seeing record numbers of cases. Mostly interestingly among young individuals, strongly suggesting the link between attempting to open and in many respects, as we saw pictures of and photos and films of, is that, and I will get back to this in a moment about responsibility, where individuals, mostly young people, were seen at bars, congregated in crowded places, many of them without masks, which really adds fuel to the fire. So our challenge today and tomorrow and next week is to try and contain these outbreaks and get us back on the track of being able to not only contain, but also to open safely. So bottom line, it's a global serious situation. It's a serious situation in the United States. The United States being a very large country and very heterogeneous, both geographically, demographically, and other ways, it's a mixed bag. Some areas of the country are doing really quite well, and others are being challenged, as the states that I just mentioned. You said to compare it, and I'll do it briefly. Right now, if you look at the magnitude of the 1918 pandemic, where anywhere from 50 to 75 to 100 million people globally died, I mean, that was the mother of all pandemics and truly historic.
That from today's late afternoon virtual town hall with Dr. Anthony Fauci and students from Georgetown University's McCourt School of Public Policy. Mo Alathy is the executive director of that school's Institute of Politics and Public Service.
This maybe is a little bit more less about the response from the government, more about the response from citizens. Look, I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're speaking out, and I'm glad that you are giving students a chance to talk with you, because a lot of people are confused right now about the state of the pandemic and what they should be doing. My wife and I every night sit down and try to figure out what we're allowed to do with our kids based on, we're comparing different news stories we've read or different pieces of guidance that we've picked up. And I think a lot of the confusion can probably be attributed to three main issues. One the evolving nature of the pandemic has resulted in more information and new information and evolving guidance. Two, a growing body of deliberate misinformation and disinformation that's being spread, much of it online. And three, the polarization and growing politicization of the discussion of the pandemic, right? I mean, just even this past weekend, the White House pointing to some of your previous comments in order to question some of the guidance. So my question is this, given all of that, misinformation, disinformation, evolving guidance, increased politics in the conversation, how do people synthesize all this information in order to make the right decisions? How do they know who to trust?
Mo, that's a good question. And it's difficult, you know, to give you a definitive answer, except that for the most part, I believe, for the most part, you can trust respected medical authorities. You know, I believe I'm one of them, so I think you can trust me. But I would stick with respected medical authorities who have a track record of telling the truth, who have a track record of giving information and policy and recommendations based on scientific evidence and good data. So if I were to give advice to you and your family and your friends of your family, I would say that's the safest bet to do, to listen to the recommendations from that category of people. But it's entirely understandable how the public can get mixed messages and then get a bit confused about what they should do.
Dr. Anthony Fauci earlier today speaking to students at Georgetown University in a virtual teleconference. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi telling CNN that she will delay the August recess if the time is needed to reach a deal on another coronavirus relief bill. The House currently scheduled to return next week, but then leave for the entire month of August. But with the Senate now expected to be in session at least for the first week, it's possible that lawmakers may need to stay in Washington longer than expected in order to wrap up bipartisan negotiations between the two chambers and the two parties. More from her interview this morning on CNN.
Recess is fast approaching. Would you be willing to forgo that or delay that to get to a deal to extend benefits?
Oh, we absolutely have to. We also have to come to an agreement. The timetable is the timetable of the American people, needing their unemployment insurance, their direct payments, their assistance for rent and mortgage foreclosure, forbearance in terms of that. And we need it for states and localities to be able to be able to pay their employees who are meeting the needs of their constituents. And you know what? We need it to open the economy by testing, tracing, treating, isolating. We need to do that. And we call upon the President of the United States to employ the Defense Production Act so that we can have the equipment to test, the equipment to evaluate the test. It's no use taking a test if you're not going to find out for a week whether you're positive or negative. The PPE that is necessary for the schools needs to be produced under the Defense Production Act. So this is a path to opening the economy and opening our schools. For some reason, the president has resisted that, but this is an absolute must.
Those comments by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Meanwhile, the mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber, saying his jurisdiction and two other spots in Florida are likely a week or two away from resorting to what he calls a strict shelter-in-place order if the coronavirus situation does not improve. On Sunday alone, Florida setting a new single-day record with more than 15,000 cases across the state. This is what the mayor of Miami Beach told CNN earlier today.
Well, it's pretty obvious what's happening, and that is that people aren't respecting this virus, especially younger people. They're going out, they're having parties, they're not exercising social distancing. And of course, they have family members who are older. And, you know, we just have too much virus in our community. We had over 3,000 cases in one day earlier this week, which is enormous in just our county. And so we just have too much virus. The positivity percentage is something like 25%. So there's too much in too many places, and you cannot protect the people who need to be protected. And that's what you're seeing in our hospitals right now.
Yeah, because early on, a few weeks ago, what we were hearing from Ron DeSantis and others are, it's just young people. It's just young people. And the implication there was they're not going to get as sick. This isn't as big of a concern. I'm not so sure that's as operative this morning.
Well, the problem is, if you step back, there has been this constant attempt to downplay all of these issues as they present themselves. I mean, for crying out loud, we had the vice president here last week telling us that we're in a much better place. And then immediately, as if the virus had a heightened sense of irony and karma, we had the worst couple days in the history of the pandemic anywhere in the world, literally in Florida. So, you know, you can't keep telling people that everything is just fine and not to worry, because this is not a virus that responds to political speaking points. It's a virus that's going to do what it wants to, and we have to do what we need to.
Dan Gelber is the mayor of Miami Beach, Florida. Meanwhile, in Virginia, Governor Ralph Northam is demanding a more robust enforcement of the current restrictions in place in order to fight coronavirus, especially in the Hampton Roads area. The governor is pointing to a recent rise in cases statewide, an increase that is being largely driven by a drastic increase in cases in the southeast corner of the state. The governor calling for stronger enforcement of current health measures in order to head off the spread of the virus across the Commonwealth.
Seen some troubling numbers and an increase in cases largely out of the Hampton Roads area. I know we all hoped that this virus would go away, but that's clearly not the case. And until we have a vaccination, it will impact everything that we plan: weddings, school openings, the November election. We are in this for the long haul. So we all need to be clear-eyed about what our health situation is and how we can continue to keep our numbers low and our people healthy.
Those comments by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam, who is also directing a number of state agencies to enforce the requirement for all residents in the Commonwealth to wear a face mask. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence in Baton Rouge, Louisiana today, that state surpassing the 80,000 mark in terms of cases, another 2,200 reported today. His visit coming on the same day as the state's Attorney General Jeff Landry announcing that he has tested positive for coronavirus. He did not meet with the vice president. And the message again focusing on the need to reopen schools in time for in-person student learning. More with Vice President Pence.
But each and every one of you have been the hands and feet of Louisiana's response. And on behalf of your president, on behalf of the entire White House Coronavirus Task Force, I just came by to say thank you. Thank you for the long hours that you've put in. Thank you for the sacrifices that your families have made. I read this morning in my devotions that we're to run the race marked out for us with perseverance and faith. And I just want to promise you, as we run this race, as we meet this moment, whether you be in emergency management or in the National Guard or part of the great FEMA team here, working with our Region 6 team, Tony Robinson, working with our leader at FEMA, Pete Gaynor, who was here in Louisiana just yesterday, we're going to make sure that the people of Louisiana and this team have what you need when you need it, and we're going to stay with you every step of the way. With that, I'm going to turn the podium, Governor, over with your permission to two senators who have been remarkable partners for the president and our entire administration in this effort. The availability of a national response, the availability of resources to the state under the CARES Act, support for families, support for businesses will continue to allow us, as we deal with rising cases, to continue to responsibly open up our economy, to be there for families in Louisiana, and we trust, as we'll talk later today, to get our kids back into school.
That from Vice President Mike Pence in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Also resisting pressure from the Trump administration, three of the nation's largest school districts announcing this week they will begin the new school year with students learning from home. Those school districts in Los Angeles, San Diego, and Atlanta beginning entirely online. Meanwhile, schools in Nashville, Tennessee plan to do the same at least through Labor Day. A number of other big cities also considering similar plans. More from Louisiana with Senator Bill Cassidy. He joined the vice president. Here's a portion of his remarks.
This is a public health crisis that has ensnared the economy. It has ensnared the educational opportunity and the employment opportunity for everyone. And I think about that because, one, I look out across everybody with this, what they do in front of them. Prisons, health care, social services, workforce. This is an all-of-government, all-of-society issue that requires an all-of-government response. I will say, as a physician who worked with those who have been particularly hit by this, both by health, by loss of educational opportunity, and loss of employment, that your response and your administration has recognized that, as well as the governor's. How do we actually address the educational opportunity, not just for LSU and Southern, Nichols, and other state universities, but for the secondary and primary schools? How do we get people back to work but support them until their place of employment reopens? So hats off to the administration for recognizing this is not just public health. It is the whole ball of wax. I will also add that there are issues. I would not be completely transparent if I didn't say several times a week, I don't get somebody calling, I don't have swabs. We don't have reagent. We have inadequate testing. I'm out of PPE. The governor, Mark Cooper, and I are on speed dial because I'm always like bugging them. Listen, we need somebody to help. You've helped. For example, one group I said, we can get FDA to give emergency approval for a compound or to make reagent if you need it. But I do think there are other solutions. You're going to see today solutions Louisiana has brought up to address some of these issues. I'll also bring to you an idea later on of what states can do with Congress's permission to band together to increase the number of tests that might be available, not just for this state, but for our surrounding states and across the nation. But I close in thanking you and the President, Dr. Birx, Admiral Girard, for making yourself available. You always have been. And I thank you not just for your availability, but for your perspective and for your energy. Thank you.
From Louisiana earlier today with Senator Bill Cassidy. And by the way, if you had August plans to travel to Hawaii, you'll need to delay your trip. The governor there announcing the state is delaying plans to allow any out-of-state visitors until September 1st. And COVID-19 is racking up the nation's debt. The federal government setting records for both the amount of money spent and the deficit it ran up in the first 9 months of fiscal year 2020, the period from last October through the end of June. During that nine-month timeline, the government spending a record $5 trillion while collecting only $2.2 trillion. And by the way, the nation's debt has now surpassed $26 trillion. At the closing bell on Wall Street, another rally for the big board, the Dow gaining 557 points, the NASDAQ rose 98, the S&P was up 42. You're listening to Washington Today.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
And welcome back. You're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. Here are some of your other headlines. As we first reported last night, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson making it official today, the UK is barring telecom companies from purchasing new equipment from China's Huawei technology company for their 5G networks. It is the latest sign of worsening relations between Beijing and the West. It also comes as the U.S. has now positioned warships, including two aircraft carriers, on exercises off the coast of China in international waters. And from California to Vermont, Colorado to Pennsylvania, 15 states and Washington, D.C., announcing an agreement that aims to make all new truck and bus sales to be emission-free by the year 2050. The goal to severely curtail greenhouse gas emissions from vehicles, requiring governments to buy electric trucks and buses. Well, as polls show a tightening presidential race in traditionally Republican Texas, presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden launching his first general election ad battle in that state. The 60-second spot is titled Tough. It's part of a six-figure multi-state ad buy that deals with the rising number of COVID-19 cases in the country. This ad also on the air in Arizona, North Carolina, and Florida.
I'm thinking of all of you today. I know the rise in case numbers is causing fear and apprehension. People are frightened, and they're especially worried about their parents, their grandparents, their loved ones who are most at risk. You know, this virus is tough, but we can stop the spread. But it's up to all of us to do it. We have to step up and do both the simple things and the hard things to keep our families and our neighbors safe. Wear a mask. Wash your hands. Stay home if you can and socially distance when you go out. I want every single American to know if you're sick, if you're struggling, if you're worried about how you're going to get through the day, I will not abandon you. We're all in this together. We'll fight this together. And together, we'll emerge from this stronger than we were before we began. I'm Joe Biden, and I approve this message.
A newly released CBS News poll indicating the president is in trouble in a number of states that he won in 2016. He is tied with Vice President Joe Biden in Arizona at 46% each, a state that Trump won by 4 points back in 2016. The two are also essentially tied in Texas at 46% for the president, 45% for Joe Biden. And the president is down in the key state of Florida, 48% to 42%, a state that the president won in 2016. And in Alabama, it is primary day for two Republicans vying to challenge Democratic Senator Doug Jones. Former Republican Senator Jeff Sessions trying to regain his seat after resigning 3 years ago to become the president's attorney general. But after the president fired him back in 2018, Jeff Sessions facing an uphill battle with former Auburn coach Tommy Tuberville. It has been a bitter and negative campaign. Here are some of the ads now on the air in Alabama.
I'll tell you that Tommy Tuberville is going to do a job like you haven't seen. He's going to take over, and he's going to be representing you and representing you well. And he's going to have a call direct line into my office, that I can tell you, because... And, you know, we had the Jeff Sessions thing. We gave it a shot. I had no idea it could be as bad as it was, but he had no clue. And he just let it get away from him. It's really a shame.
I'm Tommy Tuberville, and I'll...
We interrupt this Washington-funded Tuberville ad for breaking news. Alabama does not take orders from Washington. Fact. Tuberville's Washington's choice. Engulfed in scandal, his firm cheated people out of millions. Fact. Tuberville was sued for fraud, cut a secret deal out of court while his partner got a 10-year sentence. Fact. Washington fears Jeff Sessions. Sessions has the courage to stand up to the mob. Don't bow to Washington. Stand up for Alabama and Sessions.
I'm Jeff Sessions, and I approve this ad.
Those ads in the air in Alabama in advance of today's primary. Meanwhile, during an interview for CBS News that's airing tonight, President Trump was asked about the Black Lives Matter movement, a movement that has shaped the summer since the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer. Here's what he told Catherine Herridge of CBS News.
But George Floyd, you said George Floyd's death was a terrible thing.
Terrible.
Why are African Americans still dying at the hands of law enforcement in this country?
And so are white people. So are white people. What a terrible question to ask. So are white people. More white people, by the way. More white people.
The full interview is available at cbsnews.com. And in a lengthy interview with the Wall Street Journal, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell calling Republican voter suppression allegations as, quote, nonsense, and said that while racism still exists in this country, he said, we've come a very long way. We talked to congressional reporter Siobhan Hughes. And my first question, why the Senate leader agreed to the interview in the first place?
I don't know precisely why Senator McConnell agreed to do an interview with the Wall Street Journal, but I do know a couple of things. Number one, the conversation about race is perhaps the most important political conversation we are having today. I know that Senator McConnell has long prided himself on having a good civil rights record. And so for him, this was something that he has wanted to discuss publicly. I also know that race issues, especially about African Americans, are important in Kentucky because a young woman, Breonna Taylor, was killed in Louisville at the hands of police. And so it's something that Mr. McConnell can't ignore. He lives in Louisville, Kentucky. And there was a point at which it looked like he was going to face an African American in his Senate race in November. Now, that didn't happen. The African American candidate, Charles Booker, lost to Amy McGrath, but his influence is likely to be felt. And this was an opportunity for Mr. McConnell to get out ahead of what are likely to be some big themes as we march closer to November.
And as you pointed out, Senator McConnell is up for re-election. He is seeking a seventh term, and he now seems at odds with the president on Donald Trump's insistence of keeping the military bases named as they are, including some after Confederate soldiers and generals.
Absolutely. Senator McConnell is at odds with Donald Trump on that, even if he doesn't phrase it in a punch you in the face kind of way. But for example, 5 years ago, after a shooting in South Carolina, Mitch McConnell came out and said he thought the statue of Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, should be removed from the Kentucky State House. Now, that didn't happen until this year, but McConnell does have a record of concluding that that sort of imagery is unhelpful, not worthy of the country and shouldn't be up. So it's a clear distinction with President Trump.
And yet there still seems to be a lot of divisions between Senate Democrats and Republicans on the path moving forward. Senator McConnell, as you pointed out, had his colleague from South Carolina, Republican Tim Scott, draft the legislation. But at the moment, that doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. And in our interview, Senator McConnell was very furious with Democrats over that, because the point he made is that by blocking the Senate from even taking up the bill by having amendment votes, the country couldn't really find out where the center was, what it wanted to do going forward. That said, Senator McConnell is also not willing to take up the House bill. So you're right. At the moment, there is no path forward.
And what were his own personal thoughts about his reelection bid? Did he talk about that?
He didn't talk about his reelection bid because our focus was exclusively on issues of race, excepting I did ask him if he thought that racial minorities were at a disadvantage, if voter suppression was a problem for racial minorities. And he said it wasn't. And in saying that it was non-existent, he indicated he had been following the Kentucky primary very closely, had noted that there was very high voter turnout, and basically indicated that he expected that was going to be a factor he would have to deal with in November.
The interview and more details at WSJ.com. Siobhan Hughes, who covers Congress, we thank you for being with us.
Good to speak to you.
In campaign 2020, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden today announcing a new plan to spend up to $2 trillion over 4 years to significantly expand the use of clean energy in the transportation, electricity, and construction sectors of the U.S. economy. It's the latest in a series of economic proposals to upgrade America's infrastructure while also tackling climate change. His remarks in Wilmington, Delaware earlier today.
Last week, I talked about using the purchasing power of the federal government to reinvigorate domestic manufacturing. That's what we're going to do with the American automobile industry as well. The United States owns and maintains an enormous fleet of vehicles. And we're going to convert these government fleets to electric vehicles, made and sourced right here in the United States of America, with the government providing the demand and the grants to retool factories that are struggling to compete. The U.S. auto industry and its deep bench of suppliers will step up, expanding capacity so that the United States, not China, leads the world in clean vehicle production. We're going to make it easier for American consumers to switch to electric vehicles as well, not only by building 500,000 charging stations, but by offering rebates and incentives to swap older fuel-efficient vehicles for new, clean, made-in-America vehicles, saving hundreds of billions of barrels, millions of barrels of oil on an annual basis. Together, this will mean 1 million new good-paying jobs in the automobile industry, its supply chain, and the associated infrastructure needed to get it done. We also know that transforming the American electrical sector to produce power without producing carbon pollution and electrifying an increased share of our economy will be the greatest spurring of job creation and economic competitiveness in the 21st century. That's why we're going to achieve a carbon pollution-free electric sector by the year 2035. We need to get to work on it right away. We'll need the scientists at the national labs, the land-grant universities, the HBCUs, to improve and innovate technologies needed to generate, store, and transmit this clean energy. We need the engineers to design them, the workers to manufacture them. We need iron workers and welders to install them. We'll become the world's largest exporter of these technologies, creating even more jobs. We know how to do this. Our administration rescued the auto industry and helped it retool, made solar energy the same cost as traditional energy, weatherized more than 1 million homes, and we'll do it again, but this time bigger and faster and smarter.
We carry Joe Biden's speech live here on C-SPAN Radio. It's available on our website. And even before he spoke, the Trump campaign denouncing the plan as a costly threat to jobs in the energy sector, and his campaign seeking to link the proposal to the even more expensive Green New Deal. In a conference call with reporters, this from Louisiana Republican Congressman Steve Scalise.
But he's already indicated the direction that he plans to go when he embraced the Green New Deal and tapped AOC to be his top advisor on energy issues. We know what that kind of radical energy policy looks like. And the studies show clearly it would be devastating to jobs in America. But more importantly, it would potentially double or triple the household electricity costs for hardworking families in America. That's not the direction we want to go. You can see with President Trump's energy policy, we've actually become the dominant leader in energy production, not only able to supply all of our own needs and lower costs for families, but creating millions of good jobs and now supplying energy to our friends around the world, which actually takes leverage away from countries like Russia, who use energy as a weapon to push their socialist agenda. And so if you look at what Joe Biden's campaign has been putting out, they're already talking about $2 trillion in taxpayer subsidies to promote the agenda. And when I look at that, the only thing I can think of is, that is Solyndra on steroids. If you go back, and I was on the House Energy and Commerce Committee when we did the investigation into the Obama-Biden energy policy when they were giving out massive taxpayer subsidies to promote green energy in the past. And so Joe Biden's been here before, and you can actually see his track record, and it's a track record of failure. What we uncovered was that was Vice President Biden at the time actually put pressure on the Treasury Department to approve the Solyndra loan for over $500 million of taxpayer money, even when people in Treasury were warning that it was going to be a failure. And sure enough, Joe Biden flies to California to deliver the check personally, and then months later, the company goes bankrupt and the taxpayers are on the hook for over $500 million. Can you imagine if we now give Joe Biden $2 trillion of taxpayer money? We'll see Solyndras all across the nation.
And this is the headline at WashingtonPost.com. Biden is set to offer newly ambitious climate goals. And joining us on the phone is Dino Grandoni. He is following the story, an energy reporter for The Post. First, give us the highlights. Summarize what we heard today from the former vice president.
So Biden has promised to spend $2 trillion to turbocharge the clean energy economy in the United States, and has also promised to try to eliminate carbon pollution from power plants by 2035, which is a more ambitious goal than he has set out previously.
The politics behind all of this, there's been a lot of tension within the Democratic Party, the more moderate wing that Joe Biden represents, and the progressive wing led in part by Senator Bernie Sanders. Does today's announcement address those issues?
Yeah, it was born in part out of this committee that allies of Sanders and the Biden had put together to try to come to some sort of consensus about what the Democratic Party broadly should do with regard to climate change. And you see it in the comments that have come out in response to this plan, that a lot of the left wing of the Democratic Party, including groups like the Sunrise Movement, which have been at the forefront of this idea of a Green New Deal, a really ambitious plan to address climate change, they've come out and praised this plan. So I think we are seeing a moment where Biden is trying to reflect the general liberal energy within his party, and seems to be doing so today.
And in terms of the Trump administration, how is the campaign, how is the president responding to the vice president's plan outlined today in Delaware?
So the Trump campaign was quick to respond and to criticize this plan, saying that Biden is only pretending to be an advocate for good union jobs, and that this sort of plan that mandates renewable energy will actually kill jobs. As you probably know, and your listeners probably know, Trump has been a big advocate of the coal industry and made a lot of hay out of Hillary Clinton's comments about basically dismantling the coal industry in 2016.
And so with a record national debt, this plan, $2 trillion, how do Democrats pay for it?
So that is a question that the Biden campaign hasn't answered definitively yet. Some of his advisors have said that this might come in the form of a new coronavirus stimulus. You might remember back in 2009, the last time we were in an economic crisis, the Obama administration responded with a stimulus that help juice the clean energy economy and help lead to more cost-effective wind turbines and solar panels that we see in different parts of the country today.
More details at WashingtonPost.com. Dino Grandoni joining us on the phone. We thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And finally, a reminder, this program is available as a podcast. You can check it out at cspan.org or wherever you download your favorite podcast. For this Tuesday, July 14th, I'm Steve Scully in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your evening.